Welcome to Vaginas, Vulvas, and Vibrators with Jordan Donnell. This is a safe place to learn about women's health and sexual wellness. I'm your host, Jordan Donnell, physician assistant, women's sexual health educator, and intimacy coach. On today's episode, we have a special guest joining us to talk all about butt stuff. We are covering all kinds of tips you should know before participating in butt stuff, when to go see a provider when you have something going on with your anus, and we're even talking about why some people find anal sex pleasurable. This episode is amazing. Before we jump into today's episode, I want to tell you about Manifest Your Man. This is a six-week program to reclaim your confidence to attract the man you deserve and have been dreaming about. I am so excited for this upcoming program. In this program, we are going to cover everything from health, pleasure, communication, desires, and really getting clear on what you're looking for in a partner. This program is great for doing the work to get ready for your next relationship. To find out more information about this, go to manifest.jordandonnell.com. I am so excited for all of the women who decide to take this step to reclaiming their confidence and attracting the man they want. Joining me today is Jonathan Baker, a PA located in New York City. He specializes in managing anal pathology with a focus on HPV and other STIs. I found him through Instagram when I was doing my STI series, and we really connected and hit it off, and I have been waiting to have him on to talk with us. Jonathan is a frequent speaker at National Specialty and State CME, Certified Medical Education events. He has also been published in various peer-reviewed medical journals and received the AAPA Award in Clinical Publishing in 2015. Jonathan, would you like to go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, thank you, Jordan, for having me. I'm really excited about this. My name is Jonathan. I've been a PA for 12 years, and I've worked in a couple of different fields that's landed me in anal rectal surgery in New York City, in a really unique practice where I get to focus on sexual health, especially in the context of anal rectal surgery. And so we do everything from HPV to STIs, as well as sort of more traditional things like hemorrhoids and fissures and that sort of stuff.
Yes. And that's how I found you, was through kind of the sexual health world and the sexual health educators, and came across your Instagram profile and wanted to bring you on to talk all about for Anal August. So I know I get a lot of questions about anal sex, anal anatomy, anal everything. From like a medical standpoint, as a PA, what are some things that we need to be aware of when it comes to participating in anal sex?
The biggest thing that people forget about with anal sex is pleasure. It's like a lot of times in medicine, we focus on pathologies and problems and issues and screening and testing. But I always like to start with pleasure, because the anus is, there's so much potential for pleasure there. So just to give like a baseline, about 30% of people in the US report engaging in anal intercourse. And the majority of those people are heterosexual, as the majority of people in the US are, right? And so there's actually more heterosexual men and women having anal sex than there are gay men. That said, I am an openly gay man. Maybe I should have mentioned that in my intro. I live with my partner for 10 years. So anyways, where I'm going with that is everyone thinks anal sex is all about the prostate. The prostate's great. We love the prostate. It's a very erogenous zone. It gives a lot of pleasure. The prostate is a gland that surrounds the very base of the urine tract right at the bottom of the bladder. And when that gland is pressed on, it releases a lot of pleasure sensation. And so that's a really key part to enjoying anal sex in people who have a prostate, which is generally people who were assigned male at birth. But there's actually so much more to that. And so for our listeners who have a clitoris, the clitoris has a portion called the clitoral crux or legs, and that wraps around underneath the skin where you can't see it and ends up right around the rectum. And so there's actually a whole lot of clitoral stimulation that occurs during anal intercourse for an individual who has a clitoris. So whether you have a prostate or a clitoris, there's enjoyment to be had by all. In addition to that, there's even more, right? So there's all of these nerves that end right at the opening of the anus. And it's one of those parts of the body that just has so much nerve sensation. And those nerves feel everything. They feel wet and dry and pleasure and pain. And so there's a lot of sensation to be had there. And then there's one more piece, which is the very back end of the penis. So it's called the penile bulb. And it's the part of the penis that's also under the skin, but just right in front of the rectum under what's called the perineum or the taint. And that stimulation to that area also stimulates the penis as well. So basically, no matter what your genitals look like, you're getting some genital stimulation with anal sex. So everyone can enjoy it. It probably isn't for everyone, and that's okay. There's probably no parts of sex that are for everyone, right? But I think a lot of people enjoy anal sex, and I think a lot more people could.
I love that. And I did not realize all of that when it came to anal sex. One of the common things I hear when it comes to anal sex is that there's a lot of pressure during anal sex. Is that normal? Is that something you can anticipate? Is that something you should breathe through? What do you do with that?
Yes. So, you know, imagine you have your anus and your rectum, and it's a one-way street for, I don't know, the first 20 years of our lives. Some of us fewer years, some of us more, right? And so you only understand the sensation of your anus and rectum in one direction. And so when all of a sudden you're feeling in the opposite direction, it's like, ooh, that's weird, that's bad, that's unnormal, that's unusual. And it's just sort of that sense of something unknown that's happening. Pressure is the easiest way for people to describe. When I talked about the perianal nerves, the nerves that surround the opening of the anus, the nerves that innervate the rectum, which is the end of the intestines, have a lot less feeling to them. And so they can feel things like pressure and the sort of abdominal things that you might imagine, rather than all of those things that skin feels, like a pinprick sensation or warm or cold or those different things. So that sensation of filling the rectum from the opposite direction that you're used to is going to feel like pressure. And as long as you're anticipating that, then it's something that people can often work through. You have two sphincter, or you really have a bunch of sphincter muscles that are divided into these groups. And some of those sphincter muscles are involuntary. So these muscles that surround the anus and rectum that squeeze, some of them you control, they're voluntary, some are involuntary. And so you can't control them. And so I like to compare them to heart muscle, right? You can't control your heartbeat. It just beats, it does its thing. And so all of the same things that are going to slow down your heartbeat are going to help relax that smooth muscle of your sphincter. So things like being relaxed, deep breathing, being really comfortable with your partner. If you're in like an anxious, high anxiety situation, your heart's beating fast, your sphincter's doing the same thing. It's like clamping down. So if you're really nervous about sex, then it's going to make that a lot more uncomfortable. So that's what you can do to help reduce that sort of pressure sensation.
I love those tips because I think that's a great comparison to compare it to the heart. And people don't realize that we really only control a little bit, and the body is kind of doing its own thing behind the scenes that we don't even know about. Another question I get asked a lot is about preparing for anal sex. Is that something that's necessary or that you would recommend?
This is a hot topic for sure. And this is really like one of my areas of research. And I use the term research really lightly because I do clinical research and there is just about zero research on this topic. So you can get poop during sex. I would say fecal contamination as a professional, but we're gonna just run with poop, right? Some people like poop during sex. The majority of people do not. And so people like to avoid. The reality of the situation is anything that's going into the anus and rectum, no matter what you've done, what's clean, what preparation you've done, there's going to be some bacteria there. And for the most part, that bacteria is actually not all too dangerous. There is some stuff that spreads through anal sex through poop. And I think we may talk about that later on. But in reality, for the most part, that sort of exposure to a little bit of poop isn't going to do anything terrible. That said, people like to be clean during sex. That's part of our human nature, and that's okay. So my biggest thing is recommending that people get enough fiber and hydration that their bowel tract is working the way that it should be. And if it is, the rectum is really like this landing space. And once it fills up, you go to the bathroom and empty it. And you're left with probably about, I don't know, somewhere between 6 and 12 inches where things should be pretty clear. And so for the majority of penises, that's going to be enough space. For some penises, it might not be enough space. But when everything's moving like happily and you have enough fiber and enough hydration, there really should be a clean landing space there. The exceptions to that, if you have people who have irritable bowel syndrome, who are on certain medications, people who have sort of a lot of anxiety and stress and therefore some bowel irregularities, it can be a lot harder to accomplish that. So I generally recommend for people who are using the anus as a sexual organ to take fiber regularly. And that means fiber in your diet in the forms of insoluble and soluble fiber. And it means fiber in the forms of a fiber supplement, something like psyllium husk, which is the generic of Metamucil. There's, if you go to the fiber aisle, it like goes on for days and days and days. So you can pick and try different things and sort of see what works for you. For most people, probably the recommended dose daily should be pretty adequate in sort of clearing things out. And then depending on, you know, if you have any of those complicating factors like health concerns or medications, it might be more difficult. The thing that sometimes people do during sex that's not so ideal is to manually clean out. And so people use, I call it douching or an enema, and it's just instilling some kind of liquid into the rectum to clear things out. There's some data that show increased risk of infections like gonorrhea and chlamydia associated with that, as well as HPV. There's very small sort of like incidental research indicating that that might cause some prolapse. So I really encourage people to minimize that as much as possible. That said, again, people really like to be clean. So my rule is get all the fiber on board, get all the hydration on board. And then if you really want to go that extra mile, use something small to instill that liquid, either like a Fleet's enema bottle or like a bulb syringe. And you can just use plain water for that. It doesn't need to be sterile. The area is not sterile to start with, right? And don't add anything to it. Don't add lemon juice or vinegar. I hear all these wild things that people add. Just water is perfect, and you can put the water in up to 3 times, no more than that. If you have to do it more than 3 times, then work from the fiber end of things. Again, I really kind of discourage that because it is associated with some poor health outcomes that are minor things like infections. But ideally, if you can get there with just fiber and hydration, that's best.
I love that. I would have never thought about using fiber in preparation for anal sex. That is fabulous. And you brought up STIs. As a medical professional, I feel like we're not really taught a lot about STIs in the anal cavity. We're not taught about testing for them, screening for them. I am curious, kind of, what are your thoughts for testing in individuals who are having anal sex? Who should we test? When should we test? And how often should we test?
So it really is something that's under-discussed in medical education. And it's really actually unfortunate because the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, who we're all familiar with and vastly more familiar with lately, have actually pretty adequate guidelines about rectal STI. And so basically just about any STI that you can get anywhere else, you can get in the rectum. One of the big differences, though, is that you have all of this bacteria there and you have different sensation than you do in say, like the genitals. And so a lot of times they're totally asymptomatic. You don't feel anything whatsoever. And these infections just like hang out, and I've seen patients where I'm convinced that they've had chlamydia for a year. And if they had any partners during that time, could have easily spread it. And maybe their partner got genital symptoms from it, but they're just walking around with no idea that that infection is there. So some of the things that you can get in the rectum, gonorrhea and chlamydia are the most common of the bacterial STIs. The majority of cases of both of those don't have any symptoms. So I do recommend routine screening in anyone having anal sex. And I would sort of match that up similar to what you would do if they were having sex anywhere else. So if they have one monogamous partner, probably less frequent screening. If they have more than one partner, then we might think about more frequent screening. The test that we do is easily commercially available. So we can test the genitals as well as the throat, which is really important, and the rectum as well. There's a couple of other STIs you can get in the anus, like anal HPV or human papillomavirus, which can cause genital warts. You can get herpes on the anal area, and that can be genital herpes or that can be oral herpes. And I see so much oral herpes or HSV-1 on the anus. And And one of the other difficult parts of anal STIs is people just can't see, right? Like you feel something's going on. It doesn't feel good. Maybe you can try to set up some elaborate mirrors and like figure out what's going on, but it's probably not going to work. And you're definitely not going to get a good view of the inside. So I do recommend routine screening. So does the CDC, by the way, of anywhere where people are exposed to something. So again, that's going to be throat, genitals, and rectum, depending on what someone's doing.
And it's too bad the CDC doesn't recommend standard screening for HSV in anybody. Like, that's just not a recommendation. Do you commonly screen for that in your patients?
Oh, HSV is such an odd... The way it's approached is so strange to me. It's so common. And I think I actually listened to your episode on HSV, if I'm not mistaken. It's so common. You know, 70% of us have it. People with HSV2... 84% of us don't know we have it, right? So it's super common. Why there's no vaccine for it is so far beyond my comprehension, but that's probably a battle for another day. So I screen for if someone has symptoms, and general anal herpes will present with like pain or bleeding, sometimes discharge, often ulceration rather than like blisters, because the blisters pop really quickly because there's so much friction there. So if someone has symptoms, then I definitely swab them. When it comes to screening with an antibody test, it gets more dicey because you then don't know where that infection is, right? And so someone could screen positive for HSV1, and that's probably on their mouth, but it might not be. That could be on their anus, or where they might be positive for HSV2. And again, that might be on their genital area. It might be somewhere else. And then who knows from there? It's like, are you going to have an outbreak? Did you have an outbreak? That one time your butt was really itchy, was that herpes or was that just your butt being itchy? And then the bigger gray space that leaves is like, what do they do with partners? Should they tell their partners like, oh, I have herpes antibodies, but I don't know where the infection is and I don't know how contagious it is? So I tend to sort of stray away from screening for asymptomatic herpes just because you don't necessarily know what to do with it when it does come back positive. And I say when, because again, 70% of us are walking around with that virus.
I need to update that HSV episode because I've learned so much about it since then. And you're so right. There's just not good information about, like, what do you do with it? How do you give patients that information? And now what? I know you focus a lot on HPV, the human papillomavirus, and HPV can cause different diseases of the anus and the rectum. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that and maybe a little bit more about HPV?
Yeah, I would love to. When we talk about herpes being common, HPV is even more common. It is the most common sexually transmitted infection. The New York City Department of Health says everyone who's sexually active who prior to receipt of the HPV vaccine gets HPV. So we are all walking around with this. Hopefully some of those in the generation below us will be vaccinated before they ever get exposed. And even if you have been exposed, you should still be vaccinated. It's approved up through age 45. And I almost always see insurance cover it. I have one patient who, even after fighting with insurance, I couldn't get it covered. But the whole rest of my patient panel has it covered. It covers 9 strains of HPV. We're probably all walking around with a couple of strains, but probably not all 9 of them. And so by vaccinating, even after someone has it, you can reduce the risk of getting new HPV. And then there's a little bit of not great data that supports that the vaccine might actually reduce the risk of HPV-related disease coming back. So in one study, people who had anal warts and they got the vaccine were half as likely to have those warts come back. A lot more data to come on that. We don't know how accurate that is, but that retrospective study looking back at old data was pretty compelling. So I hope to see more data come out on that. So for those of us who haven't had the vaccine before having sex, there's a lot of things to not look forward to with HPV. So it can cause warts, and warts are really annoying. That's the term that I use all the time, because that's really what they are. They're not life-threatening. They're not going to turn into anything terrible. They're bothersome and they look bad and people don't like having them on their body, but that's really all that they are. So HPV can cause warts basically anywhere on the body. Specific strains of genital HPV will cause the warts on the genital area, the anal area, and the mouth as well. And then you have other strains of HPV, the high-risk HPVs, and those are the ones that can ultimately cause a cancer. So you could have warts with high-risk HPV in them, right? And then you could develop a cancer where that wart is. but it's actually two different strains of HPV causing that. So the high-risk HPVs can cause cancer, and that happens in that same distribution. So it can be of the mouth and like specifically the back of the throat. It can be of the genital area, especially the cervix, but also the vagina, the vulva, and the penis, and then the anus as well. And it's the same strains that cause it across all of those sites. And it happens to also be the same strains in the vaccine. So a really good reason to get it. We routinely screen for cervical cancer using a PAP, as I know you've talked about with your listeners. So I don't have to go down that road too far, except to reinforce that it's been really successful, right? We see almost no cervical cancer in people who have access to that care. When we look at populations who don't have access to routine PAPs according to the guidelines, then we start to see cases of cervical cancer. Anal cancer itself is really uncommon. The likelihood of your average person in the U.S. getting anal cancer is really, really low. But in certain populations, we see higher rates. So if you look at gay men or other men who have sex with men, our rate of anal cancer is pretty similar to the rate of cervical cancer among your average patient population who has a cervix. And then if we look at people living with HIV, we see similar rates again, so similar to the rates of cervical cancer for which we screen. And then if you compound those and you have gay men living with HIV, you see those numbers skyrocket and the risk is actually probably about 4 times higher. And so we've started screening in the late 90s. I guess that's the royal we, because I was not practicing medicine in the late 90s. But some colleagues who I actually fortunately work with on some projects had the great idea to start screening for anal cancer using an anal PAP, very similar to a cervical PAP. And that test is super easy. It's literally a Q-tip in the anus, and then you put it in the same solution that you use for a cervical PAP, send it off to the lab. Any lab can read it because those cells look exactly the same as they do in the cervix. And then if that's abnormal, then we go down a very similar road to what we do in the cervix and do a procedure called high-resolution anoscopy, which is analogous to colposcopy, which is a procedure that follows up an abnormal PAP so we can visualize and find if there's any specific lesions there. One of the big differences with the cervix is you can actually go in the cervix and remove the whole area that's prone to HPV disease. In the anus, you can't. It's too big of an area. You'd risk causing really terrible side effects, and that those side effects could affect someone's bowel habits for the rest of their life. And if they're having sex with their anus, it could affect sex for the rest of their life. So what we end up doing is treating these little lesions, and then often turns into this game of whack-a-mole, where we're like treating here, and then 6 months later, we treat over here, and 6 months later, we treat over here. And usually over time, that recurrence rate decreases, but we still see it keep coming back over the lifetime. And so what seems to be sort of a quicker road for people with a cervix is kind of a really long road when it comes to the anus. So we don't have guidelines nationally. I think we'll probably have some international guidelines that come out in the next couple of years. And then the national guidelines are probably 10 to 15 years away. And that's just based on sort of knowing the research that's going on. And it certainly will not be to screen everyone. If we just start doing anal PAPs on everyone, we're going to get all these abnormals. They're going to go through all these terrible procedures and we'll prevent very few cases of anal cancer. But when we're really strategic and we focus on these key populations, gay men, people living with HIV, other immunosuppressed people sometimes can benefit as well, especially people who might have had like a transplant or on like biological medications for psoriasis or inflammatory bowel disease, and especially when people have those overlapping factors. If you have someone living with HIV with a kidney transplant on a biological for psoriasis and they had a history of cervical HPV, like that person needs to be screened ASAP, but your average person certainly should not be. So more to come on that. The last thing I would just caution everyone is do not do an anal PAP on anyone. Don't let someone do an anal PAP on you unless you have a way to follow up on it. Because if you have an abnormal PAP and then you have nowhere to go, then all you have is anxiety. You haven't done yourself any favors. So access means you can afford it. They're in network with your insurance. You're traveling a reasonable distance. You're not like crossing state lines to go get your anus checked. So it's really, really important that people who have an anal PAP have some way of following up on that.
That's a really good point, because I think a lot of people don't think about, well, as providers, you know, one of our golden things is don't order anything that you wouldn't change your treatment plan or you don't know what to do with. And in same, you know, for patients in this situation, if they don't have access to treatment, then they're going to sit there wondering, well, is something going on? Do I have cancer? What are my next steps? And then you just kind of go in this circle without being able to get any answers. When you talk about anal paps, I'm super unfamiliar with these. Do you use a speculum or just a swab?
So there's all this absolutely wild research done in the 90s to find out the best way to do an anal pap. And the winner is a polyester tipped Q-tip, and that's just blindly inserted into the anus, blindly meaning you don't use a scope or a speculum or anything, and like pushed around and swirled for about 10 seconds. And then that generally picks up sort of enough cells to get an idea of what's going on. There was like studies looking at like brushes or these like things that sort of like opened up inside of the anus, or if we like put an anoscope in and directly visualize and try to swab certain places. And all of that was inferior to just putting a Q-tip in, which, don't get me wrong, is still uncomfortable. Even for someone who enjoys anal sex, an anal Q-tip is not fun for anyone. But I think probably a little easier than if we were, you know, having to use a scope or something like that. When we get to high-resolution anoscopy, then we're going in with an anoscope, which is pretty similar to a speculum.
And that totally makes sense that it makes it a little bit easier as a provider to do something like that. You don't need like the skills, like with a pap, it takes skills to look at the cervix. It's not something that you just wake up and you can do a pap smear. It's a lot of practice. So that actually makes it a lot easier to increase access to care for anal paps. Now, your focus is kind of in the whole anal rectal section, and I feel like we could do a whole nother podcast about this at some future point, because I think a lot of ladies that listen to this podcast could benefit from more information about fissures and hemorrhoids, and I see this coming in our future. But what are some signs and symptoms that you would recommend triggering a patient to go see a medical provider when it comes to their anal cavity?
That is a fantastic question. And I'll start with saying that the majority of my new patients are like, oh yeah, this has been going on for years. I've tried to treat it with this, that, and the other thing. Like, people don't want to get their butt checked. They really don't. And I sympathize with that. Like, of course you don't. But remember, the person you're going to get your butt checked by probably does it all day long like I do, and hopefully has decent enough bedside manner to kind of get you through the procedure. So my general rule of thumb that I've stuck with is 2 weeks is bad. So if you have a little bit of blood with one hard bowel movement and it goes away and it never comes back, no big deal. If you have a hard bowel movement and it's painful and like maybe you ate something constipated and it goes away, no big deal. If you travel and you get super constipated and that lasts a couple of days and goes away, no big deal. But if anything's making it to 2 weeks, then we're starting to wonder like what's going on. Even with little like bumps and lumps, I still use that 2 week rule, because you can get like hair follicles that get irritated. You might have little skin tags there that get irritated. Even tiny hemorrhoids that you don't need to do anything with might pop up, and that's okay. So anything that lasts longer than 2 weeks, definitely get checked out. When it comes to symptoms with anal sex and sort of what's normal there and what you should expect, the rectum is really thin and it can bleed really easily. So a little spot during sex, a little spot of blood is okay. It's not anything to get alarmed about. And if it happens the next day, that's okay. It should always be bright red. If it's not bright red, if it's like dark and clotted, that means it's coming from further upstream and we should find out what's happening there. Some pain during sex makes a lot of sense. That pain certainly shouldn't last for 2 weeks afterwards. Or if any of that's consistent. If anal sex is always painful, if you're always getting bleeding with anal sex, then that could be a sign that something else is going on. But generally, 2 weeks of anything is time to go get it checked out. And if you are that patient who's like, I've been dealing with this for 2 years and I've tried everything under the sun, so just go get it checked out. Go find out what's going on. You're never going to stop using your butt. You're going to go to the bathroom for the rest of your life. So you might as well get it in good shape.
Yes, 2 weeks is a good rule of thumb. And I actually hear that when it comes to a lot of other conditions, even mental health conditions, where after 2 weeks, if there's no improvement, no change or worsening, go get help. And I think a lot of patients don't realize that maybe they have seen somebody and they didn't get answers. They can continue to advocate for themselves and either find a new provider or get a referral to somebody who maybe has more answers for what is going on for you.
Absolutely. It's really, that's another thing that I see a lot of is patients who've seen someone else first. And there's so many things that can go wrong in those visits that absolutely, if at first someone can't figure it out, like go see someone else or go back to them sometimes even, but don't just throw your hands in the air and give up. That's the worst thing that you can do.
Yes. And I talk about that on my podcast all the time to advocate, because as a patient, you are the only one who knows what's going on with your body. And as a provider, it is my job to listen to what you're saying and kind of put together a plan, but I don't know how you're feeling. And I need my patients to tell me that information. So I have two burning questions before we wrap this up. The first is, this got brought up with a group of girlfriends of mine recently, and toys during anal sex. So I know you always want to use a toy that has a base on it. However, I've had a couple friends who use toys that have a base on it, and they still have gotten sucked into their anal cavity. What advice do you have for that?
Oh no, that's all I've got for you on that. Oh my gosh, that is such essential advice when it comes to an anal toy, right? When you're thinking about a vagina, there's a limited space. Like things can only go so far. Sometimes you've got to go fishing in there. The anus, it's like it ends at the mouth. That's the other end of the track here, right? So you have all the space in the world for something to get lost. So it is so important to have something with a flared base, so it's wider at the bottom. And ideally, that really has like a good flare. So not just triangle shape, but like bell shape, like that there's something that's really going to keep it from going in. Once something's in the anus, there is sort of a natural tendency for it to continue to move upstream. And there's a certain point called the splenic flexure, which is like right underneath the rib cage on the left side where items like to migrate towards. And so once something's on the inside, it's probably there. If it's a condom, you'll poop it out, and that's probably okay. If it's anything else, you probably need to go to the emergency room. And I don't even see these patients in my office because I'm outpatient 9 to 5. Like, they don't just like come rolling in Tuesday morning like, well, I've had the stuck cup here for a few days. Like, they are at the emergency room, and then they'll see me for follow-up 2 weeks later or whatever. So yeah, if that happens, I've got no good news for you. That's, you got yourself a trip to the emergency room and probably a colonoscopy to go fetch it out. Maybe something shorter.
Yes. So this one girlfriend that this happened to in particular, she had just posted on social media an x-ray of a situation where it happened for a patient. She's a nurse, and was like, don't do this. Make sure you use a base. And then it happened to her. And for some reason, she was able to meditate and relax enough where it was able to come out by the grace of all gods. But I know for me, like, there's no way I would relax enough. I would be in deep trouble at that point.
Oh my gosh, that is wild. Did she watch this happen to someone else? I would definitely say don't go more than, I don't know, 6 or 12 hours. If you think you have that mind control, go for it. I'm the same way. Like, my sphincter would be jammed shut. Like, my heart would be racing, and that'd be a lost cause.
Yes. So my other burning question for you is colon cleanses. I have a handful of girlfriends that do colon cleanses. What are your thoughts on those? And are those recommended or not?
There is no medical information about colon cleanses. I'm a very Western medicine kind of person. And I mentioned at the beginning, I'm a clinical researcher. So I really like to see some kind of data in front of me. But working in this field, of course, like, how do you clean up before sex? There's no clinical research trial that tells you what to do there, right? So you always have to read between the lines. So I think there's very few like commercial colon cleanses or even at home remedies that are going to be harmful. I'm sure there's stuff out there that absolutely is, but in all of it, we just have absolutely no data about it. So I probably would err towards recommending against it. If something makes you feel better for whatever reason, you can give it a try. If the only like incidental story that I have on that is a patient who had started getting, I think they were like coffee enemas or something, and developed this terrible anal itch. And 2 months later, it came to me and was like, I don't know what's going on. And I'm like, well, you started your coffee enemas 2 months ago, which is when this also started. So like, maybe that's the problem. And she just did not want to let go of it. And, you know, if you're developing symptoms from it, then I would definitely get that checked out. So I don't want to give like a hard no on it because I don't have data to support it, but I also don't have data to say like, this is going to be bad for you either. But just be cognizant of what's happening down there and if there might be something bad going on.
I love that. I have a handful of friends that do it, and I think there's some placebo effect that goes with that. But I do know from, I've tried it, what I've heard is that constipation, it can really help relieve that. I don't know about the whole cleaning the red meat out and the dairy and all that. If there's mucus, you had too much dairy. I don't know if I believe all of that. But for constipation, I know my local hospital here in Ohio sends children to have colon cleanses if they're really constipated. So who knows? What are some overall tips for a healthy rectum?
I'm going to go back to fiber on this one. Fiber is my favorite thing. So the recommended dose of, or recommended dietary need of fiber for people is about 35 grams a day. And something like a big salad has like 5 or 8 grams of fiber. If you have a lot of vegetables in your diet, you're getting some fiber. I don't think anyone in the U.S. is getting enough actual fiber. And the things that are high fiber are like beans and legumes and whole grain stuff. And some of that's part of our diet, but it's not all of it, right? We're not like a bean and grain kind of society. At least I'm in New York City, so we're like a dollar slice of pizza kind of people here. And so really probably most people would benefit from some supplemental fiber. Hydration's really big too. If you're, you know, the purpose of the large intestine is to reabsorb water from your stool. And so if you're dehydrated, your large intestine is going to reabsorb all of that water as we both like chug our glass here. It's going to reabsorb all that water and your stool is going to get really, really hard. And that's one of the biggest things that I see. And then if you're having sex using your anus and you can have that conversation with your healthcare provider, I'd really encourage you to. So that way they know if they should be screening you for anything or if there's anything else that you should be educated on. Like I said, it's super common. 30% of people are doing it. I would probably not try to find a lot of information on the internet because you're going to find some pretty wild stuff out. So if you can have that conversation with your healthcare provider, that's really helpful as well.
I love it. This conversation has been wonderful, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me today. Where can the listeners find
us? So my social media is at RectalRockstar, and I primarily use Instagram. I'm probably not cool enough for TikTok, and I'm not academic enough for Twitter. So we stick with Instagram, my primary place. My practice, I mentioned, in New York City. I doubt the majority of your listeners are like in my neighborhood ready to come see me, but if you Google me, you'll find my practice. If I happen to be nearby and meet your needs as a provider, I'm happy to see you.
I love it. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And I love so much that you're covering this topic. It's just one of those things that doesn't get the airtime that it should. And it's so common and there's so much misinformation out there. So it's really wonderful to see this like getting in the mainstream where people can learn and go have like good, safe, enjoyable sex.
Yay. Thank you so much.
This episode is sponsored by Pure Romance by Jordan Jones, offering top bath and beauty products and relationship enhancement items. Check out the link in the bio to start shopping today. By shopping, you are supporting this podcast.
Thank you for joining today and continuing to bring awareness to women's health. If you love the show, please subscribe so you never miss another episode and leave a review for others to see. If you want to see me on the daily, you can check out my bio for links to all my pages. Be sure to share this episode with your girlfriends. Thanks again and see you next episode.